From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Governor Baker is calling for a judge to be pulled off the bench amid a reported probe into whether she helped a man evade immigration officials.
She clearly violated the court's own policies with respect to the way they're supposed to handle detainers that involve federal immigration enforcement.
Also today, the story of Roland Hayes, who combined black spirituals with European opera and wowed audiences in America and Europe.
It's the story of a black man who found success in an art form that was made without him in mind. Opera was not made with the idea that people of color would be singing it.
And we remember Andy Fitzgerald, the final crew member of the Finest Hours Coast Guard boat, who died recently.
I know we did a good job and we saved a lot of people, but that was our job. I just felt happy that we did what we were supposed to do and saved people's lives.
All next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Governor Charlie Baker is calling for a Newton judge to be removed from the bench amid a reported federal investigation into the judge's actions. The Boston Globe is reporting that a federal grand jury is looking into whether District Court Judge Shelley M. Joseph and other court officials helped an undocumented immigrant leave her courtroom to avoid being detained by an ICE agent who was present in the courthouse. The defendant was in court on charges that included drug possession and what appeared to be a Pennsylvania warrant for drunk driving. Helping the defendant avoid detainment could potentially be in violation of court rules and possibly federal law. Governor Baker says the judge was out of line and should not hear criminal cases until the matter is resolved.
Judges are not supposed to be in the business of obstructing justice. And as far as I can tell, based on the facts as they were presented, she clearly violated the court's own policies with respect to the way they're supposed to handle detainers that involve federal immigration enforcement.
WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling has been following the story and joins us in the studio. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Maria.
Hi. So this happened back in April. What do we know about what went on in the courtroom that day?
Well, the Boston Globe is reporting that Judge Joseph, you know, what's at question is essentially whether she may have played a role in the defendant, Jose Medina Perez, sort of slipping an ICE agent who was in Newton District Court that day waiting to pick him up on immigration charges. And actually not just Judge Joseph, but other court personnel as well are in question here. So Medina Perez, the defendant, was in court on, as you mentioned, drug charges and a fugitive warrant for drunk driving in Pennsylvania that ICE believed was for him, that he was the person pictured in this warrant. And he was also, you know, supposed to be held on an ICE detainer. He had an ICE detainer flagged on his record, which is this request from immigration officials to hold him in custody. So the judge is recorded in a conversation with attorneys as saying, quote, ICE is going to get him. And then she suggested continuing the case or postponing the case. And at that point, the judge asks the clerk to go off the record and stops the recording of the proceedings. So ultimately, the fugitive charges were dropped that day. The drug, because he did not resemble the person in the
picture. In the mugshot from Pennsylvania.
That's exactly it.
So
the prosecutor said this.
Question about whether this was
exactly
the defendant in the courtroom was the same defendant that ICE was looking for.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Whether this was the person in question. And so that fugitive charge was dropped. The drug charges did not warrant him being kept in custody. So he was essentially free to go. And so the Globe sources have said that Medina Perez sort of got out a back door and scaled a fence and was able to avoid the ICE official that was in court that day.
And we should say, even if the judge hadn't dropped the drunk driving warrant charge against him, that charge also didn't warrant him staying in custody, right?
Right. Very important point. Yeah.
Right. So what's that question here? What potential wrongdoing is being investigated?
Well, the question really is, did Judge Joseph or other court personnel actually help the defendant, who is an undocumented immigrant from the Dominican Republic, avoid ICE custody? And there are two points of interest here for U.S. federal prosecutor Andrew Lelling, who reportedly has convened this grand jury. We should note that his office has neither confirmed nor denied that this investigation even exists at this point. But, you know, if it does exist, then it's a pretty big move. It's a far reach for a federal prosecutor to sort of be reaching into the trial court like this. But first, what would be a question is this trial court rule that both the Globe and Charlie Baker have alluded to, saying that judges and other personnel should neither help nor hinder federal agents. And then secondly, a policy that says all sessions in the courtroom that's presided over by a judge must be recorded. And as we've noted, Judge Joseph asked to go off the record at one point during that conversation.
Right. And there's about a minute's worth missing from the recording.
Yep.
Okay, so there's a bigger picture conversation going on here about whether ICE should be making arrests in a courthouse at all, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, this is certainly a broader conversation that's been happening in Massachusetts for over a year now around whether ICE should be allowed to make arrests in courthouses. Immigrants' rights advocates argue that this real fear of being scooped up by ICE is preventing some undocumented people from showing up to scheduled court appearances at all. So, you know, not only could this prevent justice from playing out in criminal cases, but witnesses of crimes may be scared off from showing up to court. Victims of domestic violence might be too afraid to show up for a hearing because they're worried about ICE presence at courthouses. So a number of organizations had hoped that the Supreme Judicial Court in our state would actually take up this question and block ICE from making arrests at state courthouses. But the SJC declined to take up that question earlier this year. Let's listen to Dereje Demese. He's the president of the Massachusetts Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and they are calling on Attorney General Maura Healey to file a lawsuit to bar ICE agents from making arrests outside state court.
We all denied access to justice when witnesses, victims of crime, are afraid to appear in court because of the presence of ICE agents.
So Demese and his organization is saying, you know, we believe that ICE should be able to do their job and detain people at work or at their home or maybe other places, just not in court.
Shannon, this feels so representative of the politics surrounding immigration and immigration policy right now. You know, here we have the state's governor, the U.S. attorney, and a trial judge all wrapped up in this topic. What does this tell us about where we are in Massachusetts when it comes to cooperating with federal immigration officials?
Yeah, it does feel like a truly unique scenario playing out right now. As you said, it's this intermingling of local politicians and figures getting caught up in a very politically divisive national topic. And, you know, Governor Baker has, ever since Trump's election, really tried to toe this sort of purple line when it comes to immigration and the president's politics on the topic. You know, Baker stood up for DACA recipients and TPS recipients and has disagreed with the president on a number of points. But he's also made it clear that Massachusetts is not a sanctuary state, and that he does want to see some cooperation maintained between state police and immigration officials when it comes to violent offenders. Judge Joseph here is a Baker appointee, another interesting nuance. And, you know, we should add, as you mentioned, I want to remind listeners that Baker has said he believes Judge Joseph should not be handling criminal cases until the matter is resolved. And then when you look to the U.S. Attorney's Office and Andrew Lelling, the fact that you know, he's reportedly deciding to investigate this matter, I think speaks volumes to his priorities. You know, the office was allocated a few extra attorneys recently to really focus in on the opioid crisis and immigration enforcement and to prioritize those topics here in Boston. And so, you know, I think that this all is, you know, we've seen, you know, nationally, if we zoom out for a second, we've seen the judiciary branch across the country really push back on a lot of the president's immigration policies. And it feels like we're seeing more and more of that tension between federal immigration policies and state and local officials. So it's going to be very interesting to watch all of this play out and see where it goes from here.
Yeah. And both sides feel like they are advocating for basic tenets of our democracy.
Right. Let justice take place and we'll see, you know, where everyone falls on the coin of whether I should be in the courthouse or not.
All right. WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, for more on this story and some other ongoing legal issues, we turn now to former Massachusetts federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So you spent almost two decades as a federal judge. I'm just wondering, what's your initial reaction to this story?
My initial reaction was to recall a case that I had where the man was had been sentenced to time served. He was supposed to be released And the U.S. attorney said to me, well, he's not a citizen. The man went crazy in my courtroom. He said, I am a citizen. I wouldn't let anyone leave the courtroom. I don't know whether that was lawful or not until the issue could be resolved. Because there's a difference between raising these claims in a criminal case where there's due process and letting the man go out the door into the bureaucracy that is the immigration system.
Or abroad.
Where he would have to contest his citizenship.
I had
insisted that everyone stay in the courtroom, and it turned out the computer was wrong and that he was a citizen. So I have considerable sympathy for this judge who looked at the mugshot and said, this is not the same person, and what can I do to protect this person's rights? What she did, I don't know. And that's part of the story here, by the way. Whatever she did, the prosecutor and the defense lawyer also agreed to it. So if that's the notion, everyone's talking about the judge having made this decision, but I would be surprised if it was just the judge having made the decision and not everybody being involved.
So do you believe that there is political pressure to deport first and respect rights later?
Yes, that's right. I do. And I think, and what's happening is that political pressure is distorting the system in numbers of ways. Our governor, let me say this clearly, has no right to criticize to direct or to suggest that a judge should be taken off a particular case. He just doesn't. He doesn't have a right to insinuate the executive into what is essentially the affairs of a separate branch. And Andrew Lelling of the U.S. Attorney's Office should certainly pause before you open up an investigation as to what was clearly not, I can't say clearly, but doesn't look like anything other than someone who may have made a misjudgment, if at all, rather than someone who is intentionally obstructing the system.
Now, some would say that this isn't necessarily an isolated incident involving public criticism of a judge in Massachusetts. For example, a Quincy District Court judge came under fire in July for setting a low bail for Emmanuel Lopez over a failed drug test. Lopez has since been accused of killing Weymouth Police Officer Sergeant Michael Chesna. And the SJC Chief Justice Ralph D. Gantz has been outspoken about this issue, and in October at the annual State of the Judiciary, he called our current situation, quote, some semblance of a threat to the independence of the judiciary and the rule of law. What do you make of those comments? And what do you think of the governor's involvement in the case? I know you say he has no right, but there should be a balance of the three branches of government.
Well, that's right. We criticize Trump, President Trump, for the things he has said about Judge Curiel, who was a Hispanic judge. We criticize him for the kinds of things because we understand that when the executive weighs in, it has a disproportionate impact on the situation. So having Governor Baker now weigh in with respect to this judge on how the court should run its business, outrageous, right? Mm-hmm. If there's a rule violated, the court will address it. The governor shouldn't. And even with respect to the cases, there was a case in Quincy where he said that the judge's decision was, quote, ridiculous and outrageous. That's not for him to say. Mm-hmm. If you really respect the branches of government, you keep your mouth shut.
Last year, the SJC ruled that police cannot detain someone solely over an immigration issue, with more and more communities refusing to or being barred from cooperating with federal authorities. What would you say to those who are concerned that ICE may be losing its ability to enforce immigration laws?
What the SJC said was that that state officials could not arrest detainees, that ICE had to do that with a proper, essentially a proper detainer. That we could, in the Lund case, the SJC case, the question was whether you can tell someone to stay in your courtroom until ICE got there. Mm-hmm. And essentially, state authorities had no authority to detain someone. So that was not cooperating. It was just saying that ICE has to do it. We can't make our state officials complicit in this. ICE, in this case, could have waited outside the courtroom. Right. What is helping or hindering? It's very interesting that the ICE official was in the courthouse. Right. Maybe he should have been outside and respected the bona fides of a Massachusetts courthouse. Maybe he should have been out. Maybe we require the federal government to do what it's going to do, but not in the four corners of an institution that is intended to protect rights in a way that ICE is not.
Okay. A courtroom is obviously a place that's supposed to operate within the rule of law. Does it trouble you at all to see court officials or potentially even a judge accused of actively helping an individual evade law enforcement officials?
We don't know, right? We know that there was this issue of turning off the tape machine, and that was troubling. How this was accomplished, nobody knows. And let me sort of change what I just said. How she did it, we don't know who did this. That is to say, she saw an issue in her courtroom which troubled her, would have troubled me, should have troubled any judge. Do I turn this person over who may not be the right person? That's a key issue here. He didn't match the mugshot. The question of how that was accomplished is a different question entirely, but her concerns were completely well taken. How is another issue?
And we should say that similar to what happened in your courtroom, here, this defendant also claimed that he's a U.S. citizen.
That's right. And as I understand it, he was picked up later on by the ICE officials. He went before an immigration judge who bailed him, who gave him bail. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a situation in which the immigration authorities, this worked. In other words, his rights were protected. But if it's in my courtroom, my courthouse, I should be concerned that rights are respected. So the ICE officials can wait outside the courthouse.
Okay. And I should say, for more on your experience of this type of issue in the courtroom, we've got a link to your Boston Globe piece on our website, radioboston.org. All right, Nancy, while we have you, I want to ask you about the latest news in the Mueller investigation. We're expecting to see Robert Mueller's memo regarding the sentencing of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn today. Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI just about a year ago. Remind us what exactly Flynn admitted to and what his original deal with Mueller's office entailed.
Flynn had admitted to lying about his contacts with Ambassador Sisolak, and he had admitted to that, and in exchange for what we understand to be no prosecution against his son, no prosecution for other activities. I don't know the scope of it, but the general reporting suggests that was actually one charge of many, and the government gave up that charge and only charged him with lying about his contacts with Sisolak in exchange for cooperation. His sentencing has been put off multiple times, which is an indication that he is cooperating more with the government. Mm. You want the sentencing to take place after all that he is supposed to do has been done. So that, have it not go on in the middle of it. And so one gets a sense that from December 2017 until now, he has been cooperating with the government. The scope of the cooperation, we won't know until we hear what's going on at the sentencing.
And what are you going to be looking for in the memo? Should we expect a lot of it to be redacted?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. A rational prosecutor would redact information that then may well bear on a continuing investigation. It may be one cue as to how close the Mueller investigation is to concluding about how much information is in this document. In other words, Mueller will disclose more if it looks like this investigation is wrapping up, because Mueller is in a very clever way telling the story of the investigation through these indictments and through these court submissions. People are saying, when is his report? At the end of the day, the indictments and the submissions by Mueller is like a storyboard, and we will be able to put up pieces of the story and then see where it's going.
So is that why you think he's including quite a bit of narrative detail in these indictments and other court filings? Is that standard procedure?
It's very unusual, actually. It's very unusual. A prosecutor doesn't want to, sort of show his hand when he doesn't have to. And then you take the indictments against the Russian nationals, which was telling the story of the hacking in the election as against individuals who will probably never be prosecuted in the United States. So it's very, very interesting. It is a storyboard, and the Flynn part is part of the story. Cohn is part of the story. Manafort and other parts, and Roger Stone and Corliss. Are also part of the story.
Mm. Well, speaking of Manafort, he's the other player we're expecting to learn about more this week. Last week, Mueller's office voided their cooperation agreement with Manafort, accusing him of lying. What do you make of that? And what are you watching for as Manafort's case moves forward?
It's hard to know until we see what he lied about. I will recite speculation, which is very interesting speculation, and that is that that Mueller knew that Manafort was going to go to the president behind his back, and that Mueller also knew, this is speculation, I have to say that again, and Mueller also knew that Manafort was lying, right? That the government has an enormous amount of data now. It's not easy to somehow create something out of whole cloth. So Manafort goes to the president and says, here's what I'm saying, just want to let you know. The president then writes his statement to be given to Mueller after he's heard from Manafort and presumably after he has seen the statement from Michael Cohen, also the false statement. He then drafts his statement based on Manafort and Cohen, and Mueller then goes after Manafort for lying and Cohen for lying. If this is true, it would be extraordinarily clever. Basically the president would be caught in a lie.
Yeah. So the president tweeted yesterday about two key players in this story, his former attorney, Michael Cohen, and Roger Stone, a longtime confidant of the president. And he had very different messages for each, polar opposites, he said of Cohen. Michael Cohen asks judge for no prison time. You mean he can do all the terrible, unrelated to Trump, things having to do with fraud, big loans, taxis, etc., and not serve a long prison term? He makes up stories to get a great and already reduced steal for himself and get his wife and father-in-law, who has the money, off scot-free. He lied for this outcome and should, in my opinion, serve a full and complete sentence. Then he also tweeted this on Monday about Roger Stone. I will never testify against Trump. This statement was recently made by Roger Stone, essentially stating that he will not be forced by a rogue and out-of-control prosecutor to make up lies and stories about President Trump. Nice to know that some people still have guts. So Trump has obviously tweeted about the Mueller investigation many times before, but do you think, in your opinion, that this may be evidence that Trump is threatening those who testify against him and essentially offering a carrot to those who stay silent?
Yes. Do I have to say more? this is part and parcel of other things, dangling pardons with respect to particular witness. No, it is really... Every once in a while when we're dealing with Trump's tweets, you have to rub your eyes and saying, are we in a rational world? The notion that he is saying, sort of picking the winners and losers in the people who are testifying, directly trying to influence the investigation is extraordinary. No other president would even weigh in on these kinds of matters at all, full stop. And right. He's weighing in this way.
Well, that's Nancy Gertner. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, a former Massachusetts federal judge, and WBUR's legal analyst. Thanks so much for your time and insight, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for carry me home.
That's Roland Hayes singing the African-American church spiritual Swing Low. He was once as well-known as classical music greats like Enrico Caruso or Arturo Toscanini. Hayes was born after the Civil War to a mother who had been enslaved on a Georgia plantation. He had a fifth-grade education, but he went on to play to packed houses on both sides of the Atlantic, with opera lovers and European royals clamoring to hear him sing. By the late 1920s, Hayes had become one of the highest-paid tenors in the world. He was also the first African-American to sing for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And he was the first black concert singer in the world to record his music and combine spirituals with European opera.
Oh,
Roland Hay's story is told in the play Breath and Imagination, which is playing at the Lyric Theater. It's produced by the Front Porch Arts Collective and Lyric Stage Company. We invited Davron Monroe, who plays Roland Hayes in the production, along with Maurice Emmanuel Parent, the director of Breath and Imagination and co-founder of the Front Porch Arts Collective, in our studio. Maurice, I want to start by asking you, what is this story really about?
So this is the story of a black man who found success in an art form that was made without him in mind. You know, opera was not made with the idea that people of color would be singing it. So he not only was able to succeed, but excel in this art form, and he ultimately found his success by not denying his roots in the church and not denying his black sound that he developed in spiritualism with his mom and through gospel, but using that to as a way to access this art form using a decidedly black sound.
Davron, you were classically trained in opera, so this style of singing, you know, wasn't new to you. And I want to ask you, what was it like to sort of revisit this art form that you're so familiar with one of the icons of the art form in mind?
Very exciting to jump into this, because it's very exciting to incorporate the spiritual aspect or the spiritual songs with the classical art form. And very much like Roland, that is a very important part of my life also, and just combining those two, the Eurocentric classical / opera studies with my ethnic and heritage roots, and just combining those two, it makes it very exhilarating to present that type of story.
But that sort of fusion, you know, also really came with some hardship for Roland. You know, this show is also so deeply about that journey of learning how to celebrate the difference in voice, right? So in the beginning, we see that Roland Hayes is sort of striving for uniformity with his voice, right? That he kind of mourns sounding different. You know, he says at one point, "My sound is as dark as my skin." Did that journey from sort of seeking uniformity to then accepting one's identity resonate with you, Maurice?
Absolutely. I want to add into something that Davron brought up. Roland Hayes would always include spirituals in his concerts, because he says spirituals are the classic music of black folks. So as we're looking at these Eurocentric art forms, it's not that people of color were not making art at this time or not around, it's that we're not included in those narratives. You know, the term of "my sound is as dark as my skin" started off as a criticism, a self kind of deprecating criticism of his own artistry, and it became a rallying cry for his mother and a point of encouragement and something to be proud of, and said, "That's what makes you unique."
You know, there's also a scene after Roland Hayes performs where a white man says, "The color of Roland's voice is so unique," and sort of he goes on and on trying to compliment Mr. Hayes. But it's also a really deeply uncomfortable moment. You know, he sort of refers to him as fascinating, and it's something that's kind of recognizable that white audiences sometimes still do, and often it's well-meaning and sometimes fetishizing. So, Maurice, do you think that a scene like that is designed to confront the audience watching Breath and Imagination?
I absolutely do. I love that question. Yeah, you know, words matter, you know, and context matters. So as much as we're saying that we're bringing our black and brown bodies to the table, we are bringing all of the culture around that, all the expectations and all the history around being a person of color in America to the table. So then you have to just be aware of the words you're saying.
Well, I want to play tape from one moment in particular that really struck me, where Roland tells his mother, Mo, that he's had enough. He wants to give up singing and teach music. And she reminds him that she was born enslaved, as were her father and grandfather, I'm sorry, who were brutally beaten. And she tells him to move forward without fear. Let's hear that.
We have always had to dance with a gun at our feet. We have always had to sing with ropes around our necks. Still, we dance. We sing. You carry the pain and promise of your people in your throat. It is who you are. It does not go away. Don't look for it to go away.
This to me was kind of the emotional heart of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that scene does for you, Davron.
At this point, Roland is thinking about giving up. And for me, a lot of us have been in that position where we want to stop doing what we're doing because it's gotten difficult. But his mother is basically, you know, giving him this hard lesson, saying, you know, I went through slavery, son, and you're complaining about someone just saying Negro to you. And she was like, things have been more difficult than that for some of us. You can't just give up because of that. You have a gift and a desire that's in you, that is burning in you, and you have to press forward with that. Mm. And while you're pressing forward, you're carrying other people along with you.
Mm.
You're paving the way for other people's dreams to come forward too. So we cannot give up when things get difficult.
Mm.
We cannot stop when, you know, something adverse comes against us. That's all the more reason to press forward and press harder to reach the goals that you want to go for.
Mm-hmm. And it's a form of protest. Like, existing as black folks in these spaces is, I love right after that scene, for me, no pressure to Yewande, who's acting, mm-hmm. but the first day of rehearsal, I said, to me, that is the heart, exactly as you put it,
indeed.
Maria, the heart of the play. Mm-hmm. I think that is that's the reason, that's what jumped out of me in the page when we were reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that is why we are doing what we're doing at the front porch. That's what POC artists have to kind of take ownership of, the fact that we are standing on the shoulders of giants,
mm.
and then existing in these spaces and making art that expresses our voices is a form of protest, and you have to embrace that.
Mm, yeah. I have one more question for you, but I do want to listen to the song that comes right after that scene. And Davron, I understand this is your favorite song of the piece. So let's listen to it.
Were you there when they laid him in the tomb?
Davron, that was your voice.
Mm.
Wow. Ooh, need a moment to breathe,
yes.
after that.
Mm-hmm.
Need to process that.
Indeed.
So beautiful. One more question for you all. To me, this play was also, in a way, about a homecoming. You know, there are these recurring scenes where we see Roland Hayes, after his success, going back to Georgia with the hopes of creating an integrated music school at the plantation where his mother was enslaved. And here's, you know, again, this world-renowned artist who has played in Buckingham Palace and is welcomed throughout Europe back in the American South. And his wife and daughter are arrested for sitting in the whites-only section of a shoe store. All three of them are beaten. And this scene sort of illustrates for us that no matter how much he has ascended, he's still a black man in America.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to bring that to the stage?
Mm.
Well, the interesting thing about that is, as we walk every day and as we reflect on things, a lot of time has passed, but not a lot of things have changed. Mm. And what I'm hoping that audiences gain from this story is that we need to foster better change for people of color. And we need to foster the ability to embrace people for their differences, the ability to not allow our differences to get in the way of our forward momentum and our successes. I applaud Roland Hayes for not giving up, because he has taught a lot of us that through your drive and through your passion, success is available available to you, in spite of the things that you may have gone through. So, you know, hopefully we can get rid of the in spite of as we continue to walk through today's society. We can get rid of that and allow people to be successful regardless of the color of their skin or regardless of their background.
Again, no pressure to this actor, but I told him, for me, that's the most important song of the whole piece. It's where he's embracing both his classical training and his sound from his family, from his heritage that he found in the church. And throughout the rehearsal process, we talked about how this is a place set in a specific time, but it has so many themes with things that are going on in our society today. And to Roland Hayes' actual quote that spirituals are the classical music of black people, I don't see how you can hear him saying, were you there in the context of this play, and not think about a good guy with a gun who's black being shot instead of, because I always trip over. I get a little emotional when I start talking about this, but it's, you know, what happens when a good guy with a gun is black? What happens to him? You know, when he sings, Lord, how come we here? We think about how can a white man go into a black church and be taken alive, but Eric Garner is killed, you know, for selling in front of a 7-Eleven. You know, so it's, why are things classical? Because they have ramifications throughout history. Why do we still do Shakespeare? Because it says it speaks to humanity in a certain way that is still applicable today. And then these spirituals, when you think about the context when they were written and when they were sung, I want to go out on the street and start singing Were You There to everyone walking by.
Yeah.
How's it an accusation? Where were you when you saw that news report? So I think that that's what, in the rehearsal process, we talked about making it clear in our minds, because I think if it's clear in your mind and clear in the way you're playing moments, it'll be clear to the audience how it's modern, but we don't have to beat anyone over the head with it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Maurice Emmanuel Parent, co-founder and executive director of the Front Porch Arts Collective, and the director of Breath and Imagination, The Story of Roland Hayes, and Davrin Monroe, a stage actor who plays Roland Hayes. You can find a link to buy tickets to Breath and Imagination on our website, radioboston.org. Davrin and Maurice, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston.
Come in by and through the lamb. One day as I was walking along the heavenly road, my Savior spoke unto me, and it filled my heart.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. On February 18th, 1952, the Coast Guard vessel CG-36-500 left Chatham in a terrible nor'easter, four Coast Guardsmen aboard. The little boat plunged through violent black water to a stricken tanker and made the greatest small boat rescue in Coast Guard history. It's a story told in the 2016 blockbuster, The Finest Hours.
You're gonna come in here scared every time you get out in the water?
Please call them back.
Start giving up on him.
Not on my watch.
He's got his orders. Get her out of here.
He's sending him out to die.
Brace yourselves.
We had a job and we did it and it worked out fine.
This was Andy Fitzgerald. He was the 36-500's last surviving crew member. And he died a few weeks ago in Colorado. He was 87. Today, we'd like to remember Fitzgerald by listening back to a conversation he had in 2016 with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty. They talked about the night of the rescue, when he was a 20-year-old engine man who'd never been over the Chatham Bar, a young man not given to heroics.
I was on summer vacation from high school. Well, I graduated from high school, that's what it was. And I was trying to think of what I would be going to do. And I was going to get drafted because I was 18 years old. And I didn't think I'd like to really fire a gun at anybody. So I got thinking about the different services and the Coast Guard. To me, in fact, a guy asked me one time if I was in the service. I said, yeah. He said, what? And I said, Coast Guard. He laughed. He says, Coast Guard, that's not a service. So I got a little upset and walked away. And then as I'm walking away, I'm thinking, wait a minute now. That's not right for him to do that. So I went back to him. I said, you know what? I said, you're right. The Coast Guard is not like the other services. You guys are trained to kill people. We're trained to save people.
But on that day in February 1952, when a nor'easter cracked the tanker ship Pendleton in half, Fitzgerald was still green. In fact, he wasn't even supposed to go out that night.
I was at the station at that time, looking to see if I could get on a boat. I had never really been on a rescue where we rescued people's lives. In other words, their lives were in danger, because I was the lowest engineman there. And I had been on calls where we would go out and take people off sandbars and things like that. But I had never gone out where somebody really was in danger of dying.
But if I got my history right, there was someone else who was actually supposed to be on the ship, right? It wasn't supposed to be you.
Yeah, I was like a third-class engineman. So Bernie Weber, who was the guy that drove our boats there, he was called into the officer in charge's office, and he said, get that 36500, get yourself a crew, and go out and help the people on the Pendleton if you can do that. I mean, try to help. You should be able to. Hopefully, you can help them.
The fact that all these years later, Fitzgerald still stumbles over that thought, well, it's telling, because everyone wondered at the time if they'd survive this mission. The Cape Cod Times put it beautifully in a recent article, writing that the crew could hear the breakers roaring away in the darkness as the lighthouse beam swept over the 36500. Bosun's mate Bernie Weber hoped they'd be called back, but they weren't. So he revved the engine and plunged into the first wave.
Well, one wave hit us, and I was lifted up in the air about 3 feet and dropped back down, but I didn't leave the boat or anything like that. The wind was 70 miles an hour. And the waves were anywhere from 40 to 60 feet high.
Huh. At night.
Yeah. And it was at night.
The boat landed on its side. Fuel ran low and the engine stalled. There's a scene in the Finest Hours movie showing Fitzgerald struggling below decks to prime the engine and get it started again.
The engine went out 3 or 4 times. We had to go down and help start him.
And you lost your windshield, too?
Yeah. A big wave came and knocked the windshield down and broke the glass on the windshield. A piece of glass got stuck in the guy that was driving the boat, Bernie Weber, and it got stuck in his cheek. And it knocked our compass off, so we had no compass either. But Bernie was a really good, what they call coxswain, which is a boat driver.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very familiar with that area. So that's why I kind of volunteered to go out and try to help, because I knew the boat was a good boat, and I know Bernie was a top-notch boat driver.
And Weber was tested that night. The towering swells tossed the 36500 the way a cat toys with a ball of yarn. Up, down, side to side. Weber had to point the boat over the crest of the waves and then gun the engine in reverse to stop the 36500 from plowing its bow into the bottom as they plunged down the back of the waves. Another wave crashed in and ripped off the compass. They were blind. No horizon line in the darkness, no direction. It was up to Fitzgerald to make his way to the bucking ship's bow and turn on the 36500 searchlight.
And then when we found the ship, I looked up and I said, whoa, there's the Pendleton. They were all holding on to the railing, standing on the top.
Well, it had cracked
and
in half.
There's a lot of people up there. How are we going to get up there and get them? And they threw over a rope ladder, and they started coming down it. And when that happened, Bernie said to himself, he told me this later, well, I'm going to go along. I have to go alongside him. We'll pick him off. So he did. He drove, and we'd come so close to that boat that we would hit it sometimes. And we did damage our boat a little bit. But I then went off the searchlight and went down to the foot of the ladder and helped the men get off the ladder onto our boat. And we did that till the whole crew was on our boat.
They'd saved 32 lives.
So now our boat, which is supposed to hold 12 people and a little thing up in front, or 8 people up front and a crew of 4, which was us four, we had in the high 30s on our boat and by the time we pulled away. And as we pulled away, that tanker that they were on flipped over, and they would have all gone into water that was 30-something degrees, 33 degrees, I think, and they would have froze.
Hmm. Wow. Did you think you were going to make it?
Yes.
You knew the whole time?
Yes. Well, I didn't know, but I thought.
Because, I mean, hearing you tell the story, the odds seemed almost impossible.
They didn't seem that way to me then. I don't know. I was only 20 years old, and it didn't seem to affect me too much. I didn't think I was going to die. I told you that because they said you went on a suicide mission. I said, no, I didn't. I said, I thought we were going to go out and save some people's lives.
You know, can I ask you, you said that when you got the crew off the Pendleton, again, in the middle of these enormous seas, in the middle of the night, that you had, more than 30 people on board your little boat, which wasn't really built to handle that. I mean, it must have been pretty low in the water. Did you think you were going to...
It was low.
Yeah.
I know some kids had sneaked out of their houses and went up on a hill and watched us come in, and they told me later, these young kids, they had sneaked out, and they said that we've never seen a boat that low in the water. We didn't realize it was that low, truthfully.
And of course, it was not certain that they'd get back to shore safely.
Put the sea behind us! Just let it push us along till we lay up somewhere!
There's a scene in the movie where Bernie Weber, played by Chris Pine, tries to rally the wet, exhausted men.
Storm's easing up, boys, so we just look for the lights on the shore to guide us in. Even if we have to go so far as Knobscot Point, so be it. We just gotta find land. What a heck of a long day, right, fellas? Yeah. Sure has. Don't you give up hope on me now. It's a good boat. She'll get us through. We'll get you home, okay? We're all going home.
You know, like you said, you were 20. You were just 20 when this happened.
Yes.
I mean, when you guys made it back and realized how many people you'd saved, and I don't know, are you standing there on the pier thinking, holy moly, look what we just did?
I just felt happy that we did what we were supposed to do and saved people's lives.
So all these years later, how does it feel to you that there's this really, really big Hollywood film that's been made about the work you did that night?
I don't think I felt any better than the old Andy Fitzgerald. I mean, I feel proud that we did it.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
You know, I have to say, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. And Mr. Fitzgerald, I'm just really honored by the fact that I kind of get a sense that you still feel like what you and your crew members did that night wasn't all that big of a deal, but it was. It was a huge deal.
Well, I know we did a good job and we saved a lot of people, but that was our job.
Andy Fitzgerald was a Coast Guardsman on the CG-36-500 back in 1952. He helped rescue the crew of the SS Pendleton off the coast of Chatham. The last survivor of that crew, he died recently in Colorado at 87. He spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2016. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Maria Garcia. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.